This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6 through 9.
Good morning. Welcome to all of you. I hope you came to the right workshop. Improving communication with your students. You're communicating that you would like to communicate and want to learn more about it, so thank you for coming. In 2009, I stepped into the classroom, into a bunch of 6th and 7th graders, or I had a bunch of 6th and 7th graders that year, and I had been told that they were not ordinary 6th and 7th graders. I don't know if you can have ordinary 6th and 7th graders, but these certainly weren't ordinary. In fact, I had been told by the principal and the parents, some of the students themselves, and fellow teachers that I was in for a challenge. I thought surely with 5 years of teaching under my belt and a TAP certificate hanging on my shelf, I'd be able to do this. Well, I had a group of 6th graders who were mostly all boys. There was a ringleader in the group who was an interesting ringleader. He took the boys along with him. In the 7th grade, there were a bunch of girls, and they were very cliquish, and I had happened to have them 2 years before that. So I was in for a challenge. I stepped into the classroom in the first day, and I was expecting I don't know exactly what I was expecting. I know I had some butterflies. I certainly was not prepared for what I found. I can't even begin to describe to you exactly what it felt like to step in there and to have these students. I couldn't get them to talk. I could sense that there were underlying attitudes that were going to be difficult to get out of them. I went home that afternoon depressed. My mom said, "I've never seen you so depressed." I didn't know what in the world I was going to do with these students. Well, 3 or 4 days into the school year, we were going to have music class. And I was excited about teaching music class. I had a lot of fun things to tell them and sing with them. And I said, okay, class, it's time for music. And this almost audible groan went over the classroom. And I thought, oh, no, this is not going to work. You can't have music class without participation from students. And even my good students, the students I had had 2 years before who I knew could sing and enjoyed singing, they had this awful look on their face. So I stood there and I looked at them and I said, "So what don't you guys like about music?" And they looked back at me like, "Are you crazy?" And I asked it again, "So what don't you like about music?" And a couple of hands shyly went up. "Well, we don't like the books, and we don't like to sing." And I was writing, making a big list on the board, "And it's boring." I said, "Oh, it's boring. Well, then I can't teach you the Crazy Moose song." And one of the girls raised her hand. "Miss Rio, I know that song. Was it boring, Steffi?" "No." "Well, then I can't teach it to you. If music is boring, I can't teach you that song." And you could tell that they were intrigued by this and maybe wanted to learn that song, but certainly wouldn't want to admit that they wanted to learn it. So I kept listing things on the board, and we had a very long list. And at the end of the class, their steam definitely died down by the end. And I said, "You know, I'm really disappointed in you all. I was looking forward to having music class this year. I had a bunch of exciting things I wanted to teach you, and if you're not into it, it's not going to work." And you could tell they felt slightly disappointed too. And to top that off, we were going to have parent-teacher conference. The parents were coming that night. And I said, "You know, I think your parents are coming tonight. I'm just going to let this list up here. That way they can have a look at it and find, you know." And, "No, you can't let it up there. No, what will they say?" And they were very adamant that I could not let it up there. I said, "Just don't erase it at the end of the day. We'll just let it up there." They were very opposed to me letting it up there. So I actually asked my principal at the end of the day, "What does he think about me letting this up here?" And he thought it was a good idea. There was only one parent of a very good student who looked at it that evening, but it definitely made an impression on the students. So the next time we had music class, I didn't say a word about music. That was a really bad word. I just said, "You know, you guys have been sitting for a while. Why don't you stand up and let's do some exercises?" So we started doing exercises and some vocal exercises, and they got these grins on their faces. And it was either after that music class or after the next music class that they said, "When's music class? Can we have music class again?" So you could tell that there was something inside them. It had just been squashed. And that year was not a perfect year. I think it's probably the year I will remember the most for the rest of my life. How did we get through it? I think one of the keys was communication. and I'd like to talk about communication with you this morning. Feel free to ask questions or comments as we go along. I know it's a big group, but just forget about all the other people around you and don't be afraid to interrupt me and ask. Does anyone need a handout? There's some up here, here and there, handouts. One here and one back there. Anyone else? The lady, yeah, and one in the back somewhere, back row. When was the last time that you had a one-on-one conversation with your students? One-on-one, you say? It's just much easier to hide behind the podium and talk to them as if they're a big crowd. It would be kind of scary to talk to them one by one. But put yourself in their shoes. Look at it from their perspective. If I would see that someone is texting in here and I would say, you know, I really don't want you all to be texting, how would you feel? Would you rather that I approached you in front of the whole crowd? Or would you rather that I took you aside and say, you know, I noticed that you were texting in class today. Which would you rather have? Do you communicate with your students? Well, yes, you say good morning to them in the morning, hopefully. And you talk to them all day long and you say good night when they go home. But do you really communicate? Do you talk to them? What do I mean by communication? I mean sitting down and having a conversation with them. And I'm thinking it's good to do this with all your students throughout the year. Talk to all of them one-on-one sometime throughout the year. You have 180 days, and I'm pretty sure most of you don't have that many students. So even once a week is fine. It's particularly the troublemakers, those who have mental blocks, and even those with learning disabilities who need to be talked to. And no, it won't fix all your problems. You won't help a dyslexic child to become undyslexic by talking to them. But you can help them by communicating to them. So why communicate? Communication shows that you care. When you take a student aside and talk to them, hopefully they know that you really care about them. You also avoid a lot of misunderstandings. I'm sure that all of you, at one point or another in your life have had a misunderstanding with someone else that you thought looked really big and you didn't know how you were ever going to talk to that person again. But you sat down and talked with them and you discovered it was really only this big. And it really didn't matter that much. That's how it is with your students. You also help students to deal with their frustration or anger rather than bottling it up. I had a sixth grade boy who got very, very angry. And time and time again, I would take him out and we would talk about it. Some of these stories that I'm sharing with you are very close to my heart. I'll have to see whether or not I can get through them. You also risk so much by not communicating. Yes, it takes time. Yes, it takes lots of emotional energy. But you're impacting lives. When you communicate, you know what your student is thinking. At least hopefully you give them a chance to tell you what they're thinking. Your student gets to learn to know what you are thinking. And through communication, you can express expectations to them. You can say, Johnny, I would like to see you doing such and such. And you can talk with them. Yes, it takes time. It takes a lot of emotional energy. But really, which is more important, teaching a lesson or working on a life? No, you're not going to put aside all your lessons to talk to Johnny or Sue. But how about 10 minutes? If 10 minutes can make a difference in your student's life, then I hope you can skip 10 minutes of lessons to talk with him. They will remember that 10 minutes for the rest of their lives. So you say, why communicate? We expect that a lot of the students that come to our schools come from good families. Well, I'm here to tell you that a lot of them don't. A lot of them come from hurting families. I could list a lot of students who come from families that really are not functioning very well. And we as Mennonites, plain people, hide our problems very, very well. And you're not likely to know that a student is hurting inside, but they will act in other ways that show you that they're hurting. You have to look for those other ways. So what do students do when they're hurting? They build walls. And they build those walls very tightly around themselves and are not likely to let people in. Why do students build walls? I'd like to hear from you. Do you have students that build walls? And if so, why? Why do you build walls?
So they don't get hurt again.
So they don't get hurt again, she said. Thank you. Any other ideas?
It might feel like no one else is going to be there to protect you, and you have to protect yourself somehow. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a wall feels like the only way of protecting yourself. Mm-hmm. Let's have one more. Yes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they feel out of control inside, so if they build a wall, they can control themselves. Yes? Did I hear one up here?
It can be a way of, they don't want other people to know that I have, this is going on. It's a way of hiding.
You think you can hide a lot behind walls, don't you? Yes. So what are you going to do with these students who have walls? I have an idea. Oh, whoops, I missed this part. Wouldn't you build a wall if learning was hard? If you were hurt, if you hated yourself and didn't want other people to see you, in order to protect yourself, as one of you mentioned. It's really no wonder these students build walls, and when they build walls, they begin to act out of that walls, and that's who we think they are. We think John is angry, or Sue is very, very shy and quiet. What if that's really just the wall, the shell that they're living out of? Their families begin to think that's who they are too. And it's a vicious cycle because we think that Johnny is the wall or the shell that he puts around himself. And then Johnny begins to think that he's that shell too and really doesn't know who he really is. So what can we do about these walls? Back to my idea. Build a ladder. You build a wall, I'll build a ladder. It isn't the easiest thing to do. It will take lots and lots and lots of emotional energy, but it will be worth it. You as a teacher have some power to build a ladder and help those walls to crumble. It might take years. You might have to walk around the wall 7 times, like the Israelites did. But hopefully you will be able to break that shell somehow. Hopefully you can build a ladder and get past the wall into the hearts of your students. So, how do you build this ladder? I'm suggesting a ladder of communication that has 4 rungs. First, you love them. And we'll be coming back to these too, so you don't have to frantically fill them in, but we are starting at the bottom of your handout now. First, you love them. Second, look into their hearts. Climbing up, you converse with them. And lastly, believe in them. So, love your students. Can you truly say that you love Johnny? Or Sue, or the troublemaker in your room. These are the hardest to love, but I'm encouraging you, love them. Love them for who God has created them to be, not for who they're acting to be. God created each one of these students, and God gave them gifts. There's something very beautiful about that student. They just don't know it sometimes. Love them because they need the most love. Sometimes it's the last thing you will feel like doing. Sometimes you would rather just get that student out of your hair, into another classroom, back to his home, just get them out of there. But what they really need is love. You will make mistakes as you're talking with them, as you're trying to love them, but they will know whether or not you love them and care about them, whether or not you have their best interest in mind. My sister and I taught together, and one of the years she had a student who was very unlovable. And he was in second or third grade. So every day, for I don't know how long, a period of time, she would make sure that she told David, I love you, every single day, for, I don't know, a month, 2 months, I don't know how long it was. Every single day, she would tell David, I love you. Most of these children have never heard those words. Now, you have to be careful how you say that and who you say it to, especially if you're in the upper grades. But you can tell them, I care about you. And I want to help you do better. It's not like you're going to say, I love you, to a high schooler necessarily. But there are ways that you can find to show them that you care. So love your students. How can you love your students? Pray for them. Oftentimes, unless you're different than me, love for these kind of students does not come naturally. There I have a picture of Christopher Dock, who was known for the amount of time he spent praying for each student in his classroom. I think he would kneel down in front of his classroom. He would sit in the students' desks. And actually, I believe his last breaths were taken on his knees, praying probably for his students. So pray for your students. I had the same student, David, after my sister had him. And David was very, very, very difficult to love. He would clomp into the classroom with his shoes untied. His hair was rarely combed. You were lucky if most of his buttons were buttoned. His shirt tail definitely was not tucked in. That was how he looked. He did not act very lovable either. He would push and shove, and he had a very low, gruff voice in which he would try to contest everything that you asked him to do. And I prayed for love for David over and over and over again. And close to the end of the year, I took my students to my grandparents to do some work. And you have to know my grandpa. My grandpa is a big guy who loves everyone, and everyone loves my grandpa. Well, we climbed into the truck after we had been working for my grandparents, and all the kids were on the back, and I was up front with my grandpa. And he looks at me and he says, "Diana, how can you stand David every day? He got irritated after being with him for only an hour." And the chills went up and down my spine because I realized that God had given me love for David. It did not really come from me. It didn't feel like it a lot of times. But God had given me love for David and had made David lovable in my eyes because God created David. So pray for your students. Pray and pray and pray some more. So I'm suggesting that you build a ladder by loving your students. And next, once you feel like you can muster up some love for them, look into their hearts. Think about, why is my student really doing this? Why are they beating up on their best friends? Why are they contesting everything I say? Why don't they do their work? What is going on with them? Step into their shoes. I challenge you again and again, every time you want to get annoyed at one of your students, think about it from their perspective. I recently listened to Alfie Cohn, who said that it's no wonder two-year-olds are called the terrible twos. All they hear is no, 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 no. And a lot of these students who misbehave also hear no a lot of the time. No, you can't do that. No, you shouldn't do that. Why aren't you doing this? Couldn't you just? Wouldn't you act out as well? So look, take a really good long look at your students. Pull out your binoculars. Look behind their walls. Look for the holes in their walls. Look for the times when they're sensitive to other students, to older students, to younger students. I had the same boy that I spoke about earlier who was very angry, was excellent with younger children. He had a very sensitive spot in his heart for younger children. He couldn't relate to his own peers, but he could get all the younger ones to play softball with him. And that's where I tried to help him see who he really is, how he's sensitive to others. So look at your students and ask, why are they doing this? What are they trying to accomplish? Are they trying to act out to get attention? These students often want lots of attention, especially those who have trouble learning. They're not achieving any sort of academic status, and they know it. They know that they are not along with the other students. They can't learn as well as them. And so they will try to get attention in other ways. They're going to be your class clowns who will make jokes or jump out of their seats when they're not supposed to or try to get attention in other ways. What they really want usually is love. And they want to be acknowledged that they are smart in other ways. Sometimes they're good in at recess time. Sometimes they have great physical capabilities. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they can't do academics or physical skills. Sometimes they have social skills. There is something that each one of these students is good in, and that's what you have to look for. And once you can spot that, which hopefully you can, if you can't, ask God to help you, then help them understand why they're doing what they're doing. I had a student named Michael in the first year of teaching who would sit in his chair and sit and sit and sit. His pencil wouldn't move. He wouldn't complete his work. He would just sit there. You've probably had some like them, or you will have some like them sometime. And I would go home and tell my mom, Michael just doesn't do his work. He just sits there. I've tried this. I've tried that. And she said, Diana, have you talked to him? No, I haven't talked to him. What's that going to help? What difference will that make? How am I going to be able to get him to do his work? And she said, try it. So I talked to Michael, and I said, Michael, what's going on here? Why aren't you getting your work done? And I found out through a number of conversations, you can't always get them to talk the first time, that he was afraid he wasn't going to be able to get his work done. So he would sit there. Makes a lot of sense, I know. So we tried all kinds of things. I would set the timer. I would say, okay, Michael, if you can try to get three problems done in 5 minutes. It was particularly in math that he would have such a hard time, and that was the beginning of the day. So if he would sit there for that part of the time, it meant a pretty bad day for the rest of the day. So try getting three problems done in 5 minutes, or see if you can get this amount done until recess. Or if you could do three problems in 5 minutes, you don't have to do the next three. And so on. We tried all kinds of things. I can remember the one day, after a number of conversations with Michael, that I went to his desk and I said, how much do you think you can get done until recess time? And he thought he could get the whole first page done. And I said, great. If you can get the first page done before recess, you don't have to do the second page. Well, I was busy helping other students teaching math, and I got back to his desk just before recess, and he had completed the entire math page, front and back. He could do it. He really could. He just needed someone to help him get past his fears and know that he could do it. And you should have seen the smile on his face after he did that. Sometimes students just don't understand why they're doing it. There was another situation in which a boy wasn't raising his hand. And he came into the principal's office. This happened to be in the last year or two. And he came into the principal's office, and I was there since my husband is the principal. And he wasn't raising his hand. Well, we knew that he could raise his hand. Some children have problems, but Joseph certainly didn't. So, Joseph, why aren't you raising your hand? I don't know. Is there something we can, we kept talking with him. And finally I said, are you doing it to be cool, to fit in with the other boys who are not raising their hand? Yeah, he said. And so then we had an opportunity to tell him, Joseph, these boys actually look up to you. And if you're not raising your hand, that means they don't want to raise their hands either. You are the leader here. So he was trying to fit in, not realizing that the other boys were looking up to him. Help your students understand why they're doing what they're doing. Austin, the boy that I've mentioned a couple times, who was very angry, was a natural leader, but he didn't know it really. He would try to coerce the boys into doing whatever he wanted them to do. And I had to take him aside a number of times. One of the times I said, Austin, do you know that you are a leader? You are gifted in leading. No, I'm not. Yes, you are, Austin. The boys look up to you. What do you mean? And we had an excellent conversation in which he discovered that he was a natural leader. And at that time, he was using his gifts. They were becoming his weaknesses. And he was actually, the boys were against him because of how he was acting. Oftentimes, a student like that, their greatest strength is also their greatest weakness. So help them to understand themselves. Help them to understand why they're doing what they're doing. Any questions so far? No? You all got it? You're building your ladders? You're loving your students? You're looking into their hearts? Next, I suggest that you converse with them. When your student misbehaves, or when they have a mental block, or when they're doing well, take them aside and talk with them. And I specifically say take them aside because most students have a poor enough self-esteem that they do not need to be corrected in front of everyone else. They're already feeling badly about themselves. I'm not saying that there's never occasion to correct someone in front of themselves, sometimes in front of the other students. Sometimes there is. Sometimes they have messed up really badly in front of the other class, and the rest of the class needs to know that they have been punished or that this has been taken care of. But for the majority of the time, take your students aside. When are you going to do this? Find a time. Remember, you're dealing with a life, and you could make a difference for eternity. I would often take my, sometimes it's okay to say, to go to the student and say, I know that you've done such and such, and we're going to talk about it at recess time. Sometimes you need to, Austin, I often had to talk to him right away because he got so angry that he would either lash out to the other students or he would not listen to what was going on in class. And he was a very bright child. He, So when he had that block in him, I knew that there was no way he was going to listen to what was going on in the class. He needed to be taken aside right then and there. And the other students understood. They knew. They could see him changing. They could see that he wanted to be different. And so, you know, sometimes I would say, read pages so and so, and I would take Austin out. Or sometimes I would put them into groups. Or sometimes I would just let them work and take Austin out and then come back and teach the lesson. So find a time. And sometimes that can be at recess. I've done that. But talk to these students personally. And let's see, converse with them. Let your students tell you what happened. It's much more effective than, remember, the two-year-old always hears, no, no, no. Well, these students have heard a lot of, have been reprimanded a lot of times themselves. And right then, the last thing they need is to be reprimanded again, because they usually know what they've done wrong. My general approach is to establish the boundaries fairly well at the beginning of the year. This is what happens if you cross this boundary. Here's where the boundaries are, so and so. And then as they begin to understand how I operate and know what they need to do and begin to quit testing the boundaries, then I am more likely to take them aside, and especially when they have done well. So initially, at the beginning of the year, I'm more likely to take them aside when they've done something wrong. Not always. You still want to take them aside when they've done well. But towards the end of the year, I am more likely to say, you know, we talked about that, and you have done really well in such and such. I just wanted you to know that you have done really well in leading the boys. So the important thing is that you talk with them. Let them tell you what happened. Sometimes I will go into a room with a child, and I will just sit there. I won't say a word until they do. And sometimes you sit for a long time. But especially if they're really boiling and steaming inside, it doesn't really work to ask questions, because they say, what does it matter? I didn't do it. They're very defensive. So sometimes if you just sit there and let them know that we're here, as soon as you want to talk, go ahead. It helps them to kind of get control of themselves, and then they're willing to start talking. So sometimes I go into a room, sit there, and wait till they talk. Sometimes I'll ask them questions, you know, tell me what happened. Why did you do that? Did you mean to do this? Do you realize what the other students thought when you did this? Is this actually what you wanted to do? What did it accomplish? Did it really help you get what you wanted by doing this? So sometimes I'm just quiet. Sometimes I will ask them questions. And then wait for them to answer. It takes a lot of practice to learn this one-on-one conversation. And as I related earlier, when I first started talking to Michael, it did not come naturally to me. To some people, it comes very naturally. My mother is a natural communicator. I was not. And it helped me to have her say, well, try this, ask this. So partner with someone who you know does communicate well and can help you out with this. But it can be learned, and it takes practice. You won't do it right the first time, or even the second, or the third, or the fourth, or the fifth, and I'm sure I haven't done it right, you know. I still don't do it right, but you can keep learning, you can keep trying. So ask your students what has happened. Let them tell you. And then it's good to repeat back to them what they've just said to you. So you say, okay, you're telling me that you kicked Johnny because he took your lunchbox. Oh, well, maybe I need to talk to Johnny. You don't tell the student that. But that helps you to know. I mean, yes, you still have to deal with Austin, who kicked Johnny. But it helps you to understand a bit more why Austin kicked Johnny. Would you feel like kicking him if he took your lunchbox? So repeat back to them what they have done for several reasons. One, so that you know, so that you can make sure you got what they said and that you understand what's happening. Secondly, so that the student knows that you understood what happened. Because these students are very often misunderstood. And it will mean a lot to them if you understand them. So repeat back to them what they've just said. I had two boys in the year that I talked about, Kyle and Austin, a different Austin, who I can't remember what they did. They somehow got into some kind of trouble. And I knew that I did not want to take Kyle and Austin into one room together. You're acting like your students. I knew that I did not want to take both of them into the same room because it's rather risky to have two against one. So I took Kyle into the room and I said, okay, Kyle, what happened? And he gave me a story. I said, okay, you can go out. And I brought Austin in, and he told me what happened, only it was a bit different than what Kyle had said. So now what shall I do? So I called Kyle back in. Can you tell me again what happened? And I just kept talking to the boys separately until I finally gathered what I think actually happened and could actually deal with them. And I did eventually bring them in together. But it's best to work one-on-one. And as I talked with them, I understood what had happened. And at least I think I did. I think eventually the stories began to mesh and work together. And a punishment was meted out for whatever the situation was. I don't remember. But they understood that I understood them. Because I wouldn't let them get by with, I think both of them lied in some case or another. You know, one said one thing, one said another thing, and part of it was true. So somehow I did get the story out. So let them tell you what happened. And if you have a couple of students who were acting out together, take them aside one by one. It works much better to do one-on-one than three-on-one. And eventually it is good to bring them together and say, okay, so I understand that this and this and this is what happened, and here's what we're going to do about it. But don't get them all together initially. It's a mess. Ask key questions. We did talk about this a little bit earlier, but make sure you ask questions and have a two-way conversation. Let them answer you. When you ask them a question, take all the time you need to have them answer. And sometimes it feels like minutes go by when you ask a question. So what did you do? And they'll sit there. And they'll sit there. And sometimes I ask again, so can you tell me what you did? And they'll sit there. And then sometimes I say, I'm just going to wait until you have an answer for me. And once they know that they're not going to get by without answering your question, they're likely to come up with an answer. But they need to know that they're going to have to answer your question. And sometimes they say, I don't know. And if I had asked a question that had a yes or no answer, and they said, I don't know, then I would say, I don't know if that means yes or no. Which do you mean, yes or no? Force them to give you an answer, not in a nasty way, but wait until the answer, or keep coming around with a different question, or let them know that you're going to wait until they give you an answer, because you need that answer. They need to know they can't get by without giving you an answer. I had a student also, my husband had a student this past year that I happened to be there when he was talking to her. And there were a bunch of students playing in the big room, and somehow a ping pong table got knocked over. And when this ping pong table got knocked over, there was only one student left standing right beside the ping pong table. Her name happened to be Sharon. And no, she did not knock that ping pong table over. Okay, well, who did? So we asked the other students if they knew what happened. No, they didn't know what happened. And my husband questioned Sharon. She didn't know what happened either. And so we found out a couple more details, tried to find out what we could. And finally, we questioned Sharon again. And we said, okay, Sharon, so what happened? She doesn't know, with tears running down her eyes. I said, oh, what are your tears about? And she just kind of looked at me. And after a while, she said, well, I guess I was by the picnic table, by the ping pong table. Oh, did you touch it? Yeah, I touched it. Do you think it's possible that you may have knocked the ping pong table over? Yeah. She had knocked the ping pong table over. She just couldn't bring herself to say that she had. So sometimes it's questions like that, key questions that put the answers in your student's mind or in their mouths. She couldn't avoid the fact that, I mean, she probably had lied to us before, but she found out that she couldn't go on lying forever. So if you have students who you know have lied to you, or you think they have, watch very, very carefully. Some students are very, very sly, especially those who like to misbehave. They're incredibly sly. Watch them with hawk eyes. And if you think they have done something, that's not a very good time to accuse them. You might be able to ask them, did you knock the ping pong table over? No, she said she didn't. Well, we went and gathered other evidence. And it was almost impossible for it to have been anyone but Sharon. So gather your evidence or watch. It wasn't like we were going to watch for another time when Sharon knocked the ping pong table over. But if you think your student is passing notes, watch. Stand by their desks, find out, and then gather some evidence. And once you have evidence, you can go back to your student and say, okay, well, what's this? And hand them the note. How did Sheila get this? Well, then they probably have to tell you. Sometimes I have had students who it feels like I never really did resolve the situation. They simply will not admit to what they have done wrong, and at that point, I choose not to let it come between us. So you have to know, is it really, really worth accusing Sam of this? Or do I just need to let this one ride and watch even more closely the next time? You have to decide which battle you're going to fight. So, you let them tell you what happened. You ask key questions. Now, you talk about change. So, the boy that didn't raise his hand, what is going to help you remember to raise your hand? And one of the boys before that who couldn't raise his hand thought that he should, make a mark every time he doesn't raise his hand. So that would help him to raise his hand the next time. Often, your students will have really good ideas of what they should do to help themselves change. It's amazing. They don't always, but give them a chance to try to come up with something. And if they can't, maybe you need to suggest several options and say, which do you think would help the most? So, do you need to tie a string? We did actually suggest to Joseph that he tie a string around his hand to help him remember to raise his hand. Do you need to do that? Do you need to tell yourself 10 times, I will raise my hand, I will raise my hand, I will raise my hand? Do you need to give them ideas of things that they can do to change? And often the first or second time that I would talk with a student, I won't punish them severely. Hopefully I don't ever punish my students severely, but I will talk with them, let them know that I know what happened, this is not acceptable, and here's what you should do instead. And then if they keep doing it, eventually I will establish some type of punishment of some kind. Another thing that I've done with students sometimes is a goal chart. So with Michael, who sat there and couldn't do his work, I said, every time you get a certain amount done in your math lesson, you can put a sticker on your chart. And once you have the chart filled up, we'll go out for ice cream or something like that. Sometimes goal charts work very well. I often try to give positive and negative reinforcement. So again, in Michael's case, if he could do 3 math problems in 5 minutes, then he wouldn't have to do the next 3. So he wanted to, I actually didn't necessarily have a punishment for him if he didn't get done, except his punishment was that he still had to do them. But the good thing was that if he got them done, he didn't have to do the next 3. So think of consequences for what's going to happen if they don't do it. Think of something that will happen if they do it. So if you are going to jump out of your seat when you're not supposed to, you're going to have to stay in at recess for 5 minutes. If you stay in your seat this entire period, you may go out 5 minutes earlier. I also like to make the punishment match the misdemeanor. So I had one boy who liked to write on his chair, on the table. Part of it he did without even thinking about it. But I knew that he could do better. So I talked to him about it and said that no, he's not allowed to do that. That's what paper is for. Well, he did it again. And so I said, we talked about it, and I said, okay, Corey, if you like to write on wood so well, tell you what, I'll bring a board in tomorrow, and you can do your math lesson on that rather than on a piece of paper. Well, don't worry, Corey never wrote on the wood again. And shock your students. If they know that if I get out of my seat, such and such is going to happen, they're more likely to jump out of their seat. If they know that they're going to jump out of their seat and they have no clue what's going to happen after that, they're not as likely to jump out of their seat. I've had students do what I call practice. So if you like to jump out of your seat every time, tell you what, you can stay in at recess and I'd like for you to jump out of your seat 10 times. So sit down, jump up, sit down, jump up. You have to practice. If you don't know what you need to do or can't do it well, I'll help you practice. That's another thing you can do. David had a very hard time writing. The student I mentioned earlier about my grandpa couldn't figure out how I could love him. His writing was atrocious. He was an intelligent boy, very, very smart, just did not want to take the time to write well. So we had a lot of writing sessions in which I helped him write and write well. So if you can meet the punishment or the consequences to what they have done, you're actually working on what they can do well in that very situation, in what they think they can't do well, if that makes sense. Questions so far? Yes.
You were talking about finding, like, questioning the student, question by question, to find and figure out what the truth really is. But have you found out that they did lie to you? Did you take consequences? Were there consequences for their lying then?
Sometimes there were and sometimes there weren't. I would definitely let them know that lying is not acceptable. And I think at least the first time, sometimes even the second time, I would say, if this happens again, there will be consequences. Usually the first time, it's kind of harsh to punish them unless they have done something really, really terrible. Does that answer your question? You can ask me more later, too. Any more? Okay, so you talk about change. And then lastly, make sure you communicate with the parents. Please, 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 don't just talk to the student. Talk to the parents. The parents need to know what's happening. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So talk to their parents. And you will have interesting responses when you talk to these parents. Some parents are totally behind you. That's unusual. Really, it is very unusual. I've had few parents who were totally behind me. They would always tend to make excuses, or it's your fault. I had a mother come up to me and rail me out because her daughter was not getting math. What she didn't know was that I spent probably 15 minutes every day helping her daughter in math, but it was my fault that she didn't know her math. So sometimes you will have absolutely no support from parents. Sometimes you will have support from them. Sometimes you will have parents who want to support you and their child. They have no clue what to do. So who will they ask? They will ask you, what should I do with my child? And since we're all parents and know exactly what to do, we have lots of answers for them and can help them out. Or not. But be prepared. And sometimes you can have suggestions. Sometimes you should say, well, ask so-and-so. Maybe they would give you an opportunity. Sometimes you have parents whom you call, and you know exactly what you want to tell them, and for the first half hour, they just unload all the problems in their lives and exactly how their daughter is terrible and how it's all their daughter's fault and it's not their fault. Just listen to them. They're hurting too. A lot of the parents of these children that I'm talking about are hurting very deeply themselves and have those walls. So you can build ladders with them too. It's harder than with your students. So we're building this ladder. You love them. You look into their hearts. You converse with them. And lastly, believe in them. Remember, these students usually feel down about themselves. They've been reprimanded all their lives. They hate themselves. What they need is someone to love them and then believe in them. And once you start believing in them, it's amazing to watch their walls begin to crumble. Your ladder won't have to be as high anymore. They begin to melt, and they feel you believing in them. Any student needs to know that you believe in them. But these need to know more than any, because most people, their previous teachers, their peers, their parents, have all been against them. Or at least they think everyone is against them. And if you can change that and believe in them and give them hope, they will thank you for it someday, hopefully. One of the best ways to believe in them and to help them feel that you are believing them is to look at the God-given gifts that they have. I have told one of my students over and over again, yes, God created you. You have gifts. You are beautiful. Well, no, I'm not. I hate myself. I can't do this. I can't do that. And I say, Joanna, God created you. You have gifts. This, you can do well. Most of these students have no clue what they're good at. You need to tell the Austins that they are natural leaders. Or Gloria, I talked to her one time. This was with these cliquish girls, and she felt left out. And sometimes she felt like she was in, and sometimes she felt like she wasn't. And I said, Gloria, do you realize that one of your best gifts is being a friend to others? She looked at me like, what do you mean? But she did. She had a natural gift of including others. She just didn't realize it. It felt to her like she didn't. But when she realized that, I could see her with the other girls. She would sometimes just kind of grin at me. And she felt empowered to be able to make friends with these other girls in a different way. They need to know what gifts God has given them. Most times they don't. So if you can help them see at least one gift that God has given them, they will feel a little bigger. Give them affirmation. You've probably taken them, hopefully, you have taken them aside a number of times for what they've done wrong. Please make sure that you take them aside for what they've done well and affirm them and say, Gloria, I saw you being a friend of those girls. That was great. And here's even another way you could do it. And even when you take your students aside for what they've done wrong, help them to know what they can do better. help them to, okay, so I took Gloria aside and I said, you've done so well in being a friend, and here's even another way you could do it. Or my brother, in first grade, he was a bully. So my mom and his teacher sat down one day and decided that for 1 week, he should bring something for the students. He somehow slip a gift to them they didn't know about. In 1 week, my brother was no longer a bully. He had so much fun giving gifts that he, yes, his bulliness ran away. So help them know how they can do well. Give them lots of affirmation. And teach them life lessons. One of the reasons I like to have my students, I like to ask my students questions, is because it gets their minds turning. Okay, so how could you have done better? What could you have done? If I would always tell them, you should do this and this and this and this, they're going to get used to that and think that someone in their life always has to tell them exactly what to do. If you can ask them questions and help them to think about it themselves, a very important question for students like this is, why am I doing this? They need to think about why they're doing this. If they can think about that, hopefully that question will stick with them for life. And anytime they want to get angry or they want to snob someone, they're going to think, okay, now wait a minute, why am I doing this? So prepare them for life, not just to live in your classroom peaceably with you and the other students. David, who was very, very sloppy, I would sit down with him time and time again. And one time I said, David, have you ever thought about the fact that your sloppiness is going to go on through life with you? When do you think it's going to stop, David? And David, he was very analytical. He got it just this fast. He kind of sat there, I don't know. David, do you think it's going to change when you're 16? Suddenly, wham, you won't be sloppy anymore? No. What about when you get your diploma? You should have learned by then not to be sloppy. Will it just change overnight? No. And he realized that unless he starts to work on his sloppiness right now, he's going to be sloppy when he's older. I said, David, who do you think is going to want to hire you? Everyone wants a sloppy person who throws their stuff here and writes, you know, makes big scrawls and doesn't throw the trash in the trash. Everyone wants a person like that, don't they? No. And he understood. Prepare them for life. Help them to think about the traits that they have. Austin, with his anger, I would talk with him time and time again. Austin, do you really want to be an angry man? No. They know they don't. But they need to think about what they need to do now to change that so they don't grow into that type of person. Teach them life lessons. So, you're about ready to enter your classrooms. Will you have any hurting students? Most likely. They'll be there if you can find them, if you open up your heart and look for them. Will you have the time and the energy to do this? Not by yourself. Not without God's help. And find others around you who can help you, who can give you support. No, you don't want to gossip about all the naughty people in your class. But there are some people who can really help you, who can give you advice. Will it take time and energy? Yes. All you've got and then some. Do you want to make a difference in your students' lives? That's up to you. How did my year go? Let's just say it was very interesting. I learned that the more I had one-on-one conversation with my students, the more we could have classroom discussion. And they started to tell me things that had happened the previous 2 years. And they kept asking me questions. They would often ask, why do we need to learn this? And I can remember one math class in particular in which the sixth grade boys were sitting up by the chalkboard. And I don't remember what we were learning. I just remember that Austin said, why do we need to learn this? And we had had this discussion, you know, I don't know how many times before, and I could tell that he was very upset and did not want to know why we had to learn this. So I thought, well, it's not going to work to have a conversation with him in here because he'll dominate it and no one else will be able to talk. So I said, do you all really want to know why you have to learn this? Or are you just asking to argue about it? And they kind of looked at me and I said it again. Do you really want to know why you have to learn this? Or do you just want to argue about it? Finally, Kyle raises his hand. I think I'd like to know. I said, okay, how many of you want to know? So all of them raised their hand except Austin and another boy who didn't because Austin didn't. So I said, okay, you two can go out in the hall, shut the door, and behave yourselves. So they get up, troop out, shut the door. And we had this amazing conversation about why they needed to learn this. And the students talked, they kept asking me questions, and we had a wonderful opportunity. I said, learning, maybe you don't need to know how to do algebra. I don't remember what the concept was. But just the discipline of you buckling down and getting your brain to learn this is an excellent exercise. There will be things in life that you will not want to do. But now's the time when you're young to learn that you are just simply going to have to do things that you want to do. And you can choose to do them with a grouchy face, or you can choose to do them happily. And we had a wonderful conversation. And after we were all done, I went out and opened the door, and the two boys were standing there. I don't think they moved the whole time. And I said, okay, you can come back in. And by the way, don't ask the other students what we talked about. They're not going to tell you. Whether or not they ever did, I don't know, but I kind of doubt that they did. Another conversation that I will never forget is one that happened, I don't remember in which class, but I asked them something about the Sunday sermon. Maybe it was in devotions, I don't know. I just remember one student, I was shocked that this student actually asked this question, but he raised his hand and said, Ms. Rio, how can I even remember the Sunday sermon, or how can I make it a part of my life? This is a sixth and seventh grader. And so I like to throw the question back to them. So what do you all think? How can you remember it? I don't remember exactly how the conversation went, but I do remember that we somehow got started talking about prayer. And does it really help to pray? They wonder, does it make a difference? And one girl raised her hand and said, Ms. Rio, sometimes I pray and pray and I think I have lots of faith, but my prayers aren't answered. Why not? And the chills went up and down my spine, because they were really seeking, they were really asking. They had learned that it was okay to ask questions, and that no, they're not going to feel like doing exactly what they should do all the time. But they wanted to learn. They knew that it was okay to communicate. So I challenge you, go into your classrooms, communicate with your students. Those are the students I remember the most, as you can tell. I have lots of stories about them. Communicate with your students. Okay, questions or comments? Yes. Good question. She asked if Michael kept on doing his math repeatedly again and again. No, not every day. I think for a while he may have, but he didn't every day. He did definitely increase in his ability to do math. I actually think he continued to do fairly well that year, but I know that recently he didn't. I mean, in his last several years, I know he didn't do as well. But what felt important to me is that he learned that he could do it. He could get past his fears. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? I'll just tell you one thing yet. When I started teaching, I thought I should teach younger grades because I was afraid I would be too bossy with them. I was sure I would be way too bossy for high schoolers. And my mom said, you can be as bossy as you want with them as long as you have fun with them. And once I thought about now I would much prefer to teach junior high or high school. Not like I teach that much. I teach my little daughter, Shayna. But I do get into the classroom some, and that's the age I enjoy. Because I learned that once they know that you're on their side and that you can have fun with them, they're often willing to do whatever you ask them to do. One more thing. I will give you my email address. I know that you might get through the year and you think, oh, I just wish she could help me in this situation or the other. Not that I'm going to have all the answers for you, but please feel free to email me. Actually, I enjoy when people ask me questions because I'm not in the classroom full time anymore. But my heart's still there. I still enjoy it. So please feel free to ask me questions if you want to. Email me questions. Gmail. That's it. You're dismissed.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.